This sermon is by Bible teacher Daniel Litton, the featured speaker on the Peace to Live By radio broadcast. This is the complete sermon without edits for time. To hear more sermons from Daniel, visit peacetoliveby.org. You can also contact the ministry at messages@peacetoliveby.org. Now, here's Daniel Litton.
John chapter 11, beginning in verse 45. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered counsel and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. In wrapping up last time, we contemplated the grand and glorious scene of Jesus of Nazareth raising his friend Lazarus from the dead, a man who had been in the tomb for 4 days. This thing that Jesus did hadn't crossed anyone's mind. No one had even thought of what might happen, in fact, what did happen. Ever since the creation of the world had there not been anything so incredible. God was solving the problem that plagued humankind, the problem of death. It's the problem that everyone desires to escape and the problem that many have tried to find solutions for. Yet Jesus, as God, provides that solution. The Jewish God has an answer that no one else has been able to come up with. No other gods, no other healers, no other healthcare professionals, no one else. People travel for miles to drink water from fountains, but those fountains can't make persons live forever. Potions and other edible things are tried, like eating lots of vegetables, but it doesn't work. The only person who has been able to beat it, the only person who has the answer, is this Jewish man from Nazareth named Jesus. No doubt, lots of people believe in Jesus on account of this miracle. How could individuals who were there, who saw it with their own eyes, not believe, right? Despite that, there is a group, and there's always a group, who goes and reports what he did to the Jewish leaders, to the chief priests and the Pharisees. They apparently don't believe or are jealous against Jesus. Perhaps they think he had Lazarus hiding out in that tomb alive for 4 days with a secret stash of food and water ready to come out at the right time. A big hoax, an elaborate hoax. Perhaps some really believe that. The Jewish leaders already aren't fans, so when they get wind of this, it only gets worse. A special meeting is called. The line of reasoning seems to go that somehow Jesus' rise to stardom will take away their power and give power rather to the hated Romans. The Romans will take over. That's what they said. The scare tactic they use. What's weird as pertains to that is that the Romans were pretty much more or less in control by this point. Anyway, it's Caiaphas who stands up and says something that he doesn't even realize he's saying. He thinks he is saying that it's better for Jesus to die than to lose the nation as a whole. In other words, he isn't trying to support Jesus, but rather note he's a necessary sacrifice to save the Jewish nation. All these Jewish leaders, including Caiaphas, feel they have no choice but to plot Jesus' death, to kill him. That's the only way they feel they can retain their power. Verse 54, Jesus therefore no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think, that he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so that they might arrest him. The fact that the chief priests and Pharisees wanted to execute Jesus for what he was doing was no secret. We probably often think that in a casual reading of the passage, but it was no secret, as Jesus himself cannot continue out his ministry in the public eye, open for all the Jews to see. Therefore, Jesus and his disciples retreat to a town called Ephraim, which is believed to be where the village of Tabe is in our current time. It is approximately 12 miles north of Jerusalem. Until the time of the Passover, they will stay there, which this Passover will be Jesus' last. Even the public appears to know of the plot against Jesus, as they are looking for him and wondering if he will indeed make a public appearance, knowing all that is at stake, that he could indeed be captured and killed for it. This also shows a lot of the people's affection for him, for those who had believed in him. Though it's presumably true also, a lot of people just wanted a show, just wanted to see what would happen in the standoff between Jesus and the Jewish leaders. It seems almost like the anticipation of a duel in the old American West. And if anyone saw him, likely those who were working with the Jewish leaders, they were to report it to them so that he might be captured. John chapter 12, verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they gave a dinner for him there. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those reclining with him at table. Being in his final days and understanding that Jesus desires to visit with his friend Lazarus one last time, and his sisters Mary and Martha. It hadn't been all that long since Lazarus had risen from the dead, and we don't know how long exactly. Yet this is the first time since he had seen Lazarus since that great event. Good sense it makes that a dinner would be thrown for Jesus. Not a very large gathering, since Martha is noted as the single server for the occasion, and they are all at one table. The disciples, it could be supposed, surely wanted to hear what Lazarus' experience had been like. After all, the man had been dead for 4 days and now was alive again. Can you imagine what this conversation at the dinner table would have been like? Here was a man who had died and come back from the dead. Now, this wasn't actually the first time this had happened, as it happened a few times beforehand, twice by Jesus, but still, to have a person there who had been in the afterlife, and they perhaps got to hear a first-hand account of what that was like. Consider the whole psychological side for Lazarus. Never again, for his whole life, would he have a fear of death. He'd been there and done that. He knew firsthand what was to come. Now, he'd gone to the waiting area, what the Bible calls Abraham's bosom, but still, this is an encouragement for us today, and that we know a human has already done this, and we ourselves can be as if we were Lazarus and know that everything is going to be fine for us in the future. Verse 3, Mary therefore took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume, but Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Jesus said, "Leave her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." We have a couple things going on in this section. First, we see in dramatic display Mary's love for Jesus as she takes something that is very expensive, and instead of keeping it for herself, she gives it for Jesus. Theologians have noted that this bottle of perfume was probably what she was saving for her wedding night one day when she would marry, and that's likely the case. It shows that Jesus to Mary is more important than her wedding day, which is saying a lot. The trading of something temporal for something eternal. Nevertheless, in all of this, there is one party pooper. That party pooper we know as Judas Iscariot. The text presents his dark side, and we get to peer into his heart. So we have two hearts in the passage. Mary's heart, who gives Jesus probably the most expensive thing she had. And on the other side, Judas's heart, who wants to pinch every possible penny. Regardless, John's note that Judas used to help himself to the money bag shows that this problem is not something new on the scene. And Jesus knew from the beginning of things who the traitor was going to be, see John 6:64. The disciples, however, they are oblivious to the whole thing. Judas isn't concerned with the poor, but rather is money hungry. He's upset because with this expensive perfume, had it been donated, he could have taken a portion of the proceeds himself. Money-minded, something God doesn't care for, by the way. As we are going to see a little later, this peering into Judas's heart shows us the motivation behind what he's going to do in the near future. Judas still tries to get what is left of the perfume until Jesus stops him. And Jesus notes what this is actually going to be used for. It's his upcoming death. He says it right there before them all, that he's going to die. Despite that, the disciples don't seem to really believe it. They don't appear to take it seriously. We know on another occasion that Peter himself rebukes Jesus for such talk, such discussion. Jesus goes so far to say that Satan himself is working through Peter, a pretty disheartening and discouraging thing to have said about oneself. See Matthew chapter 16 and Mark chapter 8. Verse 9. When the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. The arrogance and pride of the Jewish leaders and their clinging to power presents itself in how they desired to murder Lazarus because him being alive was, in effect, helping individuals to believe in Jesus. That's how much they disliked Jesus, that they desired to kill his friend as well. Interestingly, we don't really know if that was ever accomplished. Unlikely, it would seem, because Jesus will be killed himself only a few days from this moment, and at that point there would likely no longer be the need, in their eyes, to get rid of Lazarus. Yet had Jesus' ministry continued on further, Lazarus conceivably would have found himself dead again, and possibly for good. It's sad, very sad. It shows the depravity of these leaders and just how evil they had become. It brings to mind the passage from back in Genesis during the first world, right before the flood of Noah, where it says, "The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of his thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Genesis 6:5. Only we would replace man with Jewish leaders and earth with Jerusalem. The Lord saw that the wickedness of the Jewish leaders was great in Jerusalem, and that every intention of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. That's what it would read. That's what these Jewish leaders were like. That's what they had become. Verse 12. The next day, the large crowd that had come to the feast heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. So they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him, crying out, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel." And Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, just as it is written, "Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt." His disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things had been written about him and had been done to him. The crowd that had been with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to bear witness. The reason why the crowd went to meet him was that they had heard he had done this sign. So the Pharisees said to one another, "You see that you are gaining nothing. Look, the world has gone after him." Before our eyes is the popularity that Jesus had achieved by this point in time. The Jewish people, not entirely, but a lot of them, see him as the Messiah entering Jerusalem. They believe he is going to take the throne as King of Israel and rule in David's everlasting kingdom. That's what God had promised back in 2 Samuel chapter 7. This certainly must have been the fulfillment of it, and the Roman rulers have to be dimmed. Within their emotions and anticipation, Jesus' disciples had to be at their highest good feelings at this point in the journey, for this is likely why they had gone along for the ride up until this point. To rule and reign with Christ as King would be the ultimate achievement. All this time invested up and to this point would prove itself to have been a good investment. Nonetheless, we know that's not what's going to happen. Perhaps God's original plan, perhaps not. Theologians will debate regarding that. Jesus rides into the great city on a donkey, which is a pretty humble appearance. Yet it fulfills the Old Testament scripture. Notice that the crowd who had witnessed Lazarus' resurrection had been telling others what Jesus had done, verbally trying to get more and more on their side, even to believe in Jesus, perhaps. We don't know their true motives, at least yet. Maybe their desires were tied into wanting more handouts to some degree. However, the Pharisees cannot deny what is taking place, that his fame is at its highest yet. Verse 20. Now among those who went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip went and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him." Jesus' fame has become so widespread that it would appear that even Gentiles are trying to get in on the action. Now, these individuals mentioned were probably Greeks who had converted to Judaism at some point and were taking a keen interest in the Messiah. John doesn't record how Jesus dealt with them per se, though it was probably an encouragement to him in the midst of everything. Jesus does say, and this was likely directed at them and doubtless everyone around, "If anyone serves me," which would seem to imply that that includes Gentiles. The statement does have a Jewish law ring to it, but Jesus is saying that those who are under the law currently, whether they be Jews or whether they be Jewish converts like the Greeks mentioned, needed to follow him instead of the Jewish law. It was no longer simply following the Old Testament prescription, but rather following Jesus' new way instead. People who really believe in God, who believe in Jesus, will now do things the way Jesus is doing them, for he says, where I am, there will my servant be also. And Jesus notes that the Father will be all about those who follow Jesus' way. Verse 27, this is Jesus speaking. Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. The crowd that stood there and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said an angel has spoken to him. Jesus answered, this voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. The inner knowing is present within Jesus that he's about to take on the sin of the whole world. And in taking that on, that will involve a miserable death. He knows that. The culmination of his whole earthly ministry is at this point. The very thought of the whole thing is agonizing for him. He knows it's going to be bad. Indeed, he will be taking on the wrath of God for sin of all time. It's hard to even begin to fathom, and it is convicting for us and sorrowful at the same time. We know that we are part of this. We know that our own sin was responsible, at least in part, for this whole episode, for the agony that Jesus is about to endure. That's the seriousness of sin. That's the tribulation of it. That we were the ones to cause this harm to God himself. Even so, the Father isn't going to leave Jesus in that state, but he is going to rather glorify the Christ. That's the end goal. The writer of Hebrews discusses this later on. We remember the familiar verse that Jesus, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame. Hebrews 12:2. We know that verse. This is now the third and final time that the Father speaks from heaven for all to hear. The first time was at Jesus' baptism, and the second time at the Transfiguration on the mountain, both recorded in Matthew's Gospel. This is the third and final time. The mere fact that many Jewish persons are going to agree to have Jesus put to death shows the judgment that is coming upon the world, that they have betrayed their only way to be saved from their sins. The ruler of the world, whom we know as Satan, is going to lose his authority, the authority that he has had since the bad that went down at the Garden of Eden, and that authority whereby he tried to give Jesus all the kingdoms of the world if he would only worship him. Remember that? It was his to give, but Jesus, of course, wasn't interested. Thus, even though Jesus is going to gain ultimate authority by his death, burial, and resurrection, Satan will still have power within the world. He doesn't cease to exist and still has power in our day and age. As a matter of fact, Satan, in trying to get Jesus executed, seems to believe he is ruining God's plan. It's not that God and Satan were working in cooperation with each other. It's just that what Satan was doing in having Christ executed, unbeknown to him, for he surely didn't believe it, was actually in Jesus's power. Jesus had authority over his own life. Yet it had become clear by this point that Jesus was going to die via crucifixion, the way Romans put people to death. He could discern that based on the circumstances. And also, unbeknown to Satan, this death, which Satan felt he was causing, would in fact lead to the mass sharing of the gospel all around the world, wherein everyone would be hearkened to come to Christ for the forgiveness of sins. If Satan had known any of this, he would have stopped what he was doing immediately and made sure that Jesus lived. Verse 34. So the crowd answered him, "We have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" So Jesus said to them, "The light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light." It doesn't take long at all, not long at all. The crowd, in hearing what Jesus said, referring to his execution, doesn't like what they heard with their ears. That was the fear we had, wasn't it? That was the fear. The crowd appears to be so enthusiastic only as long as they think they are getting a kingdom for themselves, and wherein within this kingdom, with Christ reigning as king, they will get free stuff, get more handouts. When Jesus speaks about dying, that doesn't sound to them like they will get what they want. That doesn't sound appealing to them. Ironically, and this goes for anyone listening today, the way to get everything one could possibly want or need is to believe in Jesus for the forgiveness of sins. Even if not in this life, in the next life will many relationships and possessions be had. Besides, we obtain the best relationship anyone can have with anybody, and that is with God himself. But that's not what the crowd is focused on. Their anticipation had to do with material goods, tummies filled, and total earthly power. And Jesus appeals to them one more time, his fear as it did for Satan in the past, and the fallen angels, and as can arguably happen for some human beings today, is that the darkness will overtake them. The darkness will overtake them. Their hearts will become so hardened that they can no longer see the truth as it really is, and the opportunity to believe ceases. The crowd, right before their eyes, had the opportunity to believe with Jesus standing right there. Once Jesus was gone, that opportunity to believe would be gone, and Satan would have his way with them. It was hard to say whether they would gain another opportunity, another person for the light to shine into their hearts once more. That's why Jesus will, in not too short a time, send out the 11 with the commission to go around the world to share the gospel so that people have the opportunity, that these people had at this moment. The opportunity is there to see a person who represents Christ, to see some light shine toward their heart, which may illuminate things to the point that they actually choose to believe. Jesus said on another occasion, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Matthew chapter 9 and verse 37. These individual persons may see another Christ representative, or they may not. Everyone gets to choose their own destiny, to choose whether they will believe or not. The choice belongs to the person, and it takes the illumination of the light to make that choice.
You've been listening to Daniel Litton, featured Bible teacher on the Peace to Live By radio broadcast. To hear more messages from Daniel Litton, you can visit peacetoliveby.org. That's peacetoliveby.org. You can also contact the ministry at messages@peacetoliveby.org. This message is protected under copyright law, all rights reserved.